talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're returning to the history of the Oscars to reveal the worst winners and the films and people who were robbed as we debate the good, the bad and the ugly of the most famous film awards in the world.
Good evening and welcome to the Academy Awards. This really is the biggest movie event of the year, and we're here to honour all this year's incredible films and the actors and actresses that have starred in them.
Welcome to the Oscars. For those of you watching around the world, it has been a tough couple of days for us here. It has been raining. We're fine. Thank you for your prayers.
We are here at the Oscars.
Yes. That's right. Where movie lovers unite and watch TV.
This year, the Academy hired three women to host because it's cheaper than hiring one man. It's fun, right?
Yeah, it's fun. You're right.
Good evening, everybody. I'm delighted to be here. I'm Billy Crystal. I'll be your master and commander tonight and well into tomorrow. So let's get going. Gentlemen, start your egos. It's a wonderful night for Oscar. Who will win? Yes, here we are, the 76th Oscars, and he's still gold. His hip is titanium, but he's still gold.
You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Last week, we looked at FDR and the New Deal as we explored the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in November 1932 and how he brought his unique leadership style to bear to tackle the Great Depression. And if you want to listen back to that or to any of our older shows, just go to the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud, our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's show is on the good, the bad and the ugly of the Oscars. In previous years on Talking History, we've explored the history of the Academy Awards from the first ceremony in 1929 to how they have evolved, especially since 1953 when they were broadcast on television for the first time. But in tonight's show, we want to do something a little different as we look at some of the worst decisions of all time, the undeserving winners and the people and movies who were robbed, as well as find out about the downright strangest results of all time. We'll also hear about how Ireland and Irish actors and films fit into this story. And so to help me with all of this, I'm delighted to welcome our brilliant panel of experts. Professor Mark Glancy is Professor of Film History at Queen Mary University of London, an expert on transatlantic film perspectives, the films of Alfred Hitchcock, as well as the Hollywood studio system. His books include Cary Grant, The Making of a Hollywood Legend. Professor Kevin Rockett is a film historian, writer and scholar, and is a former chair of the Irish Film Institute. And he's a fellow emeritus of Trinity College Dublin and a former head of the School of Creative Arts there. And his books include the co-authored Film Exhibition and Distribution in Ireland, 1909 to 2010. Professor Ruth Barton is professor in film studies at Trinity College Dublin and expert on Irish and Irish-American cinema. She's the author of a critical biography of the film star Hedy Lamarr and of the Irish silent film director Rex Ingram. Dr. Con Holohan is Director of the Centre for Creative Technologies and Lecturer in Film and Media Studies at the University of Galway. An expert on space and place in European and Hollywood cinema, he's the author of Cinema on the Periphery, Contemporary Irish and Spanish Cinema. Well, you are all very welcome. But Mark, I'm going to start with you, precisely because two of the people who you are an expert on, Alfred Hitchcock and Cary Grant, you could say that both of them were very much snubbed by the Oscars and very much mistreated, and that they are people who should have been better honoured. And maybe we might start with Alfred Hitchcock. Why on earth did he never win a Best Director Oscar?
Well, a very good question. He made so many wonderful films, so many very popular films, so many films in which other people, actors, actresses, writers, won Oscars, but he never got the award himself. I think there's a kind of snobbery that works here against horror. That's basically horror films very seldom win. I think The Silence of the Lambs is the only horror film ever to win Best Picture. And Kathy Bates once won Best Actress for Misery. But otherwise, the Academy really doesn't like horror. They did like Rebecca, which was his first Hollywood film, Hitchcock's first Hollywood film. And it was probably his least horrific film, or one of his least horrific films. And it won the Best Picture. So, of course, that award goes to the producer and not to Hitchcock himself, who was nominated but sat there without an award that night.
But there are so many movies in the early period or middle period, like To Catch a Thief or Rope or Rear Window, all of the 39 Steps. There are so many that I wouldn't consider horror at all. And yet, and they were so innovative in terms of the style and technique, that was there a certain kind of snobbery, I wonder, because they were popular or because they were doing things in a way that perhaps other movies weren't?
Well, let me widen that definition of what Hitchcock does to the suspense thriller as well, the thriller. That is not a genre that the Academy likes. And so I think he was snubbed over and over again for that reason. I don't think To Catch a Thief got a single nomination. That's a very entertaining film, but those films are seen as light entertainment. And when you look at what kinds of films win, they're usually much more staid and something that the industry feels is going to cast itself in a good light as a worthy, fine, upstanding industry.
And Mark, it also shows that sometimes a movie can be, and we'll talk about some of these, sometimes in a particular year, everyone can be almost in agreement, oh, that's a great movie and that's not so great. And then within maybe 2, 3, 5, 10, 20 years, the movie that everyone thought was great is completely ignored, and that it's very clear that there was something else that should have been recognised.
Yes. I mean, over and over again, that happens. And so there's so many films that are well remembered now that were snubbed. It would be hard to know where to begin with that list, because it does tend to be, the decisions tend to be in the fashion of the moment, or they tend to be political. Somebody lost a couple of years earlier, and so they want to give them the award for the current year. They quite often get it wrong.
Yes, because I even wonder, you know, someone like Jennifer Connelly, who's absolutely brilliant, probably should have won for Requiem of a Dream, Requiem, but instead won for, what was it? It was A Beautiful Mind. So it was in a way that they were almost like making up for the mistake, like a referee in a match. I should have given a penalty earlier, so I'm now going to give something much softer later in the match.
Absolutely, over and over again. And with Alfred Hitchcock, he did eventually win a Lifetime Achievement Award. So they recognized towards the end of his life, oh my gosh, we've never given this man an award before. We better give him a Lifetime Achievement.
Tonight's recipient of the Thalberg Award is a picture maker of such impressive credentials he is long overdue in formal recognition from his fellows in the Academy. I deem it a personal privilege to acknowledge what theater audiences have recognized for a third of a century. When you examine the list of his films, you're jolted by the legion of absolutely top-level entertainments he has made. A record almost unmatched by any director practicing his magic anywhere. His first job in films is in 1920, writing subtitles for Silence in England. 1925, he made his debut as a director, and he still is contributing to a body of work so distinctive that his name has passed into the language. The name, of course, is Alfred Hitchcock. From his unforgettable The Lady Vanishes through Rebecca, Lifeboat, Spellbound, Rear Window, Psycho, his briefly titled masterpieces of suspense, adventure, and humor have endeared him to film buffs as certainly as his own fey presence on the small screen have endeared him to television audiences. Ladies and gentlemen, the familiar figure of Alfred Hitchcock.
Thank you.
Indeed. Similarly, Cary Grant never won an Oscar, but towards the end of his life, once he'd retired, they gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award, recognizing the sort of failings of the Oscar system.
And just on that, why didn't Cary Grant get one when he made over 70 films? He was there over so many decades, an iconic movie star, one of these genuinely great movie stars. And he was nominated a couple of times, but not to win ever. It seems like an incredible snub.
It is an incredible snub, and it really hurt him. I mean, he really took it hard. He stopped going to the awards at some point because he was so angry about this. So I think it's telling. The two films that Cary Grant was nominated for were both melodramas rather than comedy. So Penny Serenade and None But the Lonely Heart were the two films he was nominated for. Penny Serenade in 1942, None But the Lonely Heart in 1944. And in both films, there's such melodramas that Cary Grant actually cries, something it's hard to imagine Cary Grant doing in any other film, but he cries. And that's the kind of acting the Academy likes. And so in his other films where he plays the sort of debonair, man about town, wry humor, all that, they thought he was just playing himself. He was such a good actor that he made it look easy. And that's, the Academy wants to see its acting. It doesn't want easy acting or easy looking acting. It wants to see something. It wants something it can chew on.
Kevin, I don't even know if we should be doing a show on the Oscars, given that they seem to get so much wrong. And people seem to view the Oscars as this, you know, quality brand. You know, it's the Q symbol for quality, and that if you've won an Oscar, then that was a magnificent achievement and it's a great mark of quality for a movie. But yet, as we know and as we'll see, there are so many bad results and, you know, strange decisions that, you know, you could challenge the whole credibility of it.
Well, look at the really example that's quite close to home is Maureen O'Hara was devastated for not being nominated for The Quiet Man. And eventually they gave her an honorary Oscar not too long before she died.
I'm so proud to receive this award because it comes from my peers who represent every element of the motion picture business. Believe me, the admiration is mutual.
There's all sorts of, as Mark is saying, all sorts of decisions that are made that are to do with the moment, can be to do with the politics of the situation, and certainly something that was so close, in fact, to Irish people, but also to the brilliant Maureen O'Hara, not being able to get that nomination, which really was a big upset for her.
Has there ever been a tie, Kevin, between two possible winners?
Well, there was Catherine Hepburn and Barbara Streisand won.
So it was shared.
It was a shared.
The winner, it's a tie. The winners are Catherine Hepburn in Lion in the Winter and Barbara Streisand.
When I asked Miss Hepburn what she thought when she had broken the record for breaking the records for nominations, she said, "I suppose if I've lived as long as I have, anything can happen." And I'm absolutely thrilled that it has happened. Thank you very much.
Hello, gorgeous. Yeah. Well, I'm very honored to be in such magnificent company as Catherine Hepburn. And, gee whiz, it's kind of a wild feeling.
But one of the strangest of them all, of as it were, of these joint decisions was the incredible one in 1944 when Barry Fitzgerald was nominated not just for Best Actor, but Best Supporting Actor for the same film, Going My Way, and he actually won it. It's the only time it's actually ever happened. So that was a particularly strange decision, where he was nominated twice for the same film in two different categories.
And did he win for both?
No, he just won for one.
He won for one. Like, that's extraordinary that he had to win for something if they thought he was so brilliant they were putting him up in two different categories. And Con, what do you make of the Oscars when you have people like Hitchcock missing out, and you have Citizen Kane, I think it only get one at the time, but then in years to come came to be seen as one of the greatest films, if not the greatest film of all time, that there are these kind of injustices and anomalies?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Citizen Kane famously lost out to How Green Was My Valley, which, you know, I don't think anyone remembers in the same kind of category as Citizen Kane. I mean, if you look back, I think, over the last, say, 10, 15 years, there's films like The King's Speech, Argo, The Shape of Water. Yeah, films that are fine, but, you know, that they're kind of ho-hum. For me, the greatest travesty of them all was 2005 when Crash beat Brokeback Mountain to the Best Picture. And Crash is truly a terrible, terrible film. It's the most Hollywood take on racism ever. It's all these intersecting stories where, you know, everybody interacts and everyone has these racist interactions, and at the end just kind of says, well, you know, kind of, why can't we all just be nicer to each other rather than actually trying to explore the causes of racism? So, but it's one of these films that, you know, Hollywood makes and feels better about itself because it's, you know, really tackling the issues. But, you know, Brokeback Mountain was by far the outstanding film that year. But when it came to it, the Oscar, you know, the Academy members, or not enough of them, could bring themselves to vote for a film about two gay cowboys. So, yeah, I mean, as you say, when you look back through it, you wonder how great a marker of quality it is. But, you know, every now and then it recognises great work too also.
Oh, you could put Do the Right Thing, not nominated, and the and Driving Miss Daisy as the other side of the black experience in America is the one which is a much more sanitised version. That is the one that actually was nominated.
So, Kevin, does that reflect the views, the prejudices, maybe even the ideals and aspirations of the Academy voters, that their kind of politics or their instincts or their feelings tend to decide and cloud who they're voting for?
Well, I think, as has been well rehearsed in recent years, the issue around race has been one from Hattie MacDonald, who, and for Gone with the Wind, was the first black nominee. And when she even went to go to get the Oscar, she was actually segregated. They had to get a special permission to allow her to go into the hotel. She was segregated within the award ceremony. She wasn't even allowed to go to the premiere in Atlanta of the film. And it wasn't until Halle Berry got an Oscar in about 2012 that there was the next black person who was in that acting category.
And then, Ruth, you see that they attempt then to correct some of these errors of previous years by voting for movies or voting for stars who perhaps, you know, weren't the best in the category that particular year. And I'm thinking back to Green Book from 2019.
Yeah, I think there's a number of sort of compensation, and this is something that Mark was talking about as well. You get the kind of compensation Oscar. So Green Book, absolutely. And if you've seen it, you'll know it's a really standard period drama. I mean, it's really a kind of white guilt award, I would have said, that one, because it's okay, it's a story, you know, it's a black story, it's reached into the past to tell a black story, but it's told it in a really white story way. And so it's almost as if it's trying to make, you know, the white audience feel good about itself by going to see a black story and then giving that film an award. In the end, it's just a very, very conventional period drama. And I'd also add in from slightly further back in time, again, you know, sort of backing up something that Mark was saying, The Departed in 2006, far and away not Martin Scorsese's best movie. But then, you know, think of all the great movies that he made, you know, The Taxi Drivers and all those, you know, fantastic gangster films. He didn't get anything for those. And then he makes The Departed, which is kind of an okay entertainment movie. It's not fantastic. But they suddenly realise, oh my goodness, you know, we need to give Martin Scorsese an Oscar. So they whip in and give him one for that. So it's really, I mean, it's kind of like a barometer of the taste of the time, I think, much more than a barometer of value.
And Ruth, what about Martin Scorsese? Because he was always the most famous example. Well, I suppose him and Hitchcock, up until he actually won for The Departed, as you said, in 2006, that it was always, why didn't he win for Raging Bull or Goodfellas or all of these brilliant movies? And I suppose it's why didn't he win for those really groundbreaking, innovative movies? Taxi Driver, I don't think he was even nominated for Best Director for that. And yet he wins for a movie, okay, that's okay, but it's not one of his great movies.
No, it's not one that he's going to be remembered for. I mean, I think that in those films were probably slightly too edgy. And again, you know, we're talking about, you know, Kevin was talking about the compensation, the composition of the actual electorate for these awards. And at the time, they would have been very much a kind of older generation of actors, directors, and so on, who would have looked at Scorsese as sort of upstart, trying to, you know, upturn the apple cart. Also, you know, looking at subjects that they themselves wouldn't have made or wouldn't have acted in. So I think this kind of innate prejudice of the people who were deciding the awards was making it really difficult for Scorsese to be recognised for what he did. And again, you'd think probably Scorsese's films at that time were possibly appealing not to the vast amount of cinema goers who were going to the movies, but perhaps to a slightly more niche audience. So, you know, all those things, it's amazing to us at the time, just as it's now, just as it's amazing about Hitchcock. But at the time, it was probably slightly more understandable.
Slightly more understandable. And Mark, an actor like Al Pacino kind of fits into that category as well, you know, winning for Scent of a Woman in 1992, but, you know, probably should have won much earlier.
Yes, I mean, I think Scent of a Woman is probably his worst film. I could barely sit through it. I thought it was just a horrendously overdone performance. And of course, there were loads of things that he could have won for quite rightfully earlier in the 70s, particularly. But I think they felt like they had to give him an award at that point. And so he got it for this really overblown performance. And we might add one over Stephen Rea in The Crying Game, which is clearly who should have won.
So, Mark, how do you explain then these kind of differences, these kind of judgments? Is it that perhaps the people who are making these decisions, like who does make the decisions? Because how do you get into the Academy?
You get into the Academy by working in the industry and being nominated by others who are already in the Academy. And then if you are a director, you get to nominate, you get to put forward who is going to be in the nominations for director. And then the entire Academy votes on it. So within each category, whether it's director, actor, writer, the people in that particular profession or that side of the profession nominate people, and then the whole Academy votes.
And then, Mark, what about the Oscars tonight? Because the people who are listening to the show live don't know who the winners are. The people who are listening to this as a podcast will already know the results, so they'll be able to test some of these things against what you're saying. But there do seem to be some examples tonight where movies that probably should have been nominated were perhaps too edgy and weren't nominated. And I'm thinking of maybe Saltburn and movies like that perhaps, you know, not quite what the Academy were looking for.
Yes, I was very surprised that Saltburn didn't get any nominations. I thought it would at least get something for, say, writing, if not performance. And then the other film that seems to have been completely overlooked is All of Us Strangers, written and directed by Andrew Hay and starring Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal. Just a wonderful story and a very innovative story. I would have thought, again, writing and acting nominations would have been in order there. Completely overlooked. It is the year of Oppenheimer and Poor Things, I think. I would guess it's going to go to Oppenheimer, but I really have. One can't predict these things.
And Mark, why do you think Barbie was relatively overlooked as well?
Well, as we were saying earlier, they don't like light entertainment. They really want to go for something that looks either very serious, like Oppenheimer, or very innovative and with acting that you know is very overt, as in Poor Things.
So, Kevin, what about that? We could have had a load of Irish Oscar nominations tonight. Barry Keoghan for Saltburn, Paul Mescal, Andrew Scott. There are all of these brilliant examples. Are there examples of other Irish stars overlooked?
Well, overall in the history of the Oscars, and there's been about 120 Irish nominees, of which really about 100 of them have been nominated since My Left Foot won the two Oscars, Brenda Fricker and Daniel Day-Lewis, and was nominated for 5. So most of the Irish nominees in the Oscar history has been in more recent decades, which is hardly surprising considering how international and commercial really Irish cinema has become in the last 40 years. And within that sort of range of Irish nominees, probably about half of them really are working on what we call non-Irish productions, commercial productions. They're not Irish themed films and the like. So in most of them, and a great many of them, are within the technical categories of not just for the acting categories, but for makeup, for costume design and sound and the like. So in that sort of sense, that the high profile actors, and the one in particular who's got most nominations is Daniel Day-Lewis, who's got 6 nominations. He's won 3, starting with say My Left Foot, and a great many others have been nominated but not have actually won.
And the Oscar goes to Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot.
You've just provided me with the makings of one hell of a weekend in Dublin.
And the Oscar goes to Brenda Fricker in My Left Foot.
I don't believe this. And I'd like to thank every single member of the crew who worked on My Left Foot, who created an atmosphere of fun and love and hard work. I'd like to thank Christy Brown, just for being alive. I'd like to thank Mrs. Brown, his mother. Anybody who gives birth 22 times deserves one of these, I think. I'd like to thank Jim Sheridan and Shane Connaughton for the best script I've ever been involved in. I'd like to thank Noel Pearson for producing the film, and Jim Sheridan for just being the most incredible director, and the members of the Academy for giving me this, which I will take very proudly with me back to Ireland.
And Daniel Day-Lewis does stand out as, you know, one of the greatest actors of all time. You know, I don't think Lincoln was a brilliant movie, but I think he was brilliant as Lincoln. And watching it, you thought you were watching the real Abraham Lincoln and the way he inhabited the role, and, you know, incredible power there. And, you know, he'll definitely always be talked about in the pantheon of greatest actors of all time.
Yeah, no, that is undoubtedly the case. And the example already cited about Maureen O'Hara, the great actress who didn't get an Oscar. And it was, of course, in a period when there was a fairly limited range of Irish people working in the Hollywood film industry, and that the people that we, in a way, from the, shall we say, the pre-1989 period, we would associate more with John Ford, of course, the great Irish-American director, and to others. But in fact, going back to the very beginning, the person who was Dublin-born, some people will dispute it, but it seems that he always said it, Cedric Gibbons, who designed the statuette, that remains the same design into the present. He is the person that in the whole history of the Oscars has got more nominations at 39, won 11, more than anyone ever has got in the history. And he, in fact, has his name on 1,500 different films as credit. But John Ford, of course, remains the director who has got more best director awards than anyone else. And so there's these, as it were, Irish-American associates that are there. Even going back to the very first 1929 Oscar nominations, Herbert Brennan, who was born in Dunleary, lived in Ireland only until he was 2, was a great silent film director, that he was somebody who was very, very well regarded, but whose career wasn't in Ireland, but elsewhere, because there was no film industry really here until the 1980s.
And Ruth, Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, has been in brilliant movies. And I sometimes think that if an actor is seen as more of an entertainer or someone who does these popular movies and big box office movies, someone like Tom Cruise, who has done some excellent performances throughout his career and has been nominated in the past, but I think there's maybe a prejudice against that type of actor.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that, I mean, that's why we're seeing Oppenheimer really coming through so strongly. I mean, I think Cillian Murphy is fantastic in it, but it's real Oscar bait. It's a serious film. It's a history film. They like history films. They actually quite go for biopics as well, which it is.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
They have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
So that's a kind of made for Oscar film. Not that it was made with the intention of winning Oscars, I don't expect, but it's such a classic Oscar winner. The one that kind of did surprise me last year, film I hated actually personally, but was Everything Everywhere All at Once, if you remember that, which is real light entertainment. And I sort of felt with that one that it was the Academy sort of wanting to show that it was in touch and that it didn't just give it to serious, worthy films. And so they did it last year. This year they come back, they look at Oppenheimer, they look at Barbie, and they say, yeah, we'll go for Oppenheimer. So I think you're absolutely right. People who take those serious roles in those kind of films are much more likely, A, to be nominated, which even in itself is hugely important for an actor's career and for the box office of the film, but B, to actually win.
Well, tonight it is our special Oscar show on Talking History. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about some winners from the past that have been forgotten by time and also hear more about some of these undeserving winners. That's Talking History on News Talk. Right back after this. Welcome back to Talking History for our special Oscar edition of the show. I'm delighted to be rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Mark Glancy of Queen Mary University of London, Professor Kevin Rockett, former chair of the Irish Film Institute and fellow emeritus of Trinity College Dublin, Professor Ruth Barton of Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Con Holohan of the University of Galway. Con, tell us about some of these movies that did win, but then have kind of disappeared from the popular imagination from popular culture, and that we never seem to hear about them, or it seems that in some cases it almost is impossible to see them.
Sure. Well, I mean, a film that I have been telling anyone who will listen about for the last number of years is a film that was, it didn't win now, but it was nominated for Best Film in 1931, a film called East Lynne. And unfortunately, if you want to see East Lynne, you have to go to UCLA in Los Angeles, because the only complete copy of it is there. And it's, so it's one of only a couple of films that have been nominated for Best Picture that aren't actually available. There is a very poor quality version on YouTube with the ending missing, and it has a fantastic ending. But East Lynne is really interesting, because East Lynne was a book written in 1861 by a writer called Alan Wood. And, well, certainly the publicity for the film claims that in the late 19th century, it was the second most read book in English after the Bible. But it was a hugely popular book, and a hugely popular book that was adapted to the stage all the time. So there was a joke that used to go around theatrical troupes in the late 19th century that if they were putting on a play and there was no one at it, at the end of the play they'd say, next week, East Lynne, because East Lynne was guaranteed to pull in the crowd. And so by 1931, it was about the ninth time this film had been made. It was directed by a guy called Frank Lloyd, who'd won an Oscar a couple of years earlier and won again the following year. And it had, as its set designer was a guy called Joseph Urban, who was a hugely well-known architect at the time. Amongst other things, he designed Mar-a-Lago, the current home of Donald Trump. But this film was, it was a kind of film, a genre known as the fallen woman film. It seems very old-fashioned to us now. It's about a woman who kind of gets kicked out of her home for sexual indiscretion. But it was a huge film in its time. It was a big prestige film. And really influential on a cycle of films that came after it in the kind of two or three years after it. There were lots of films kind of made along the same time. But it's very much fallen out of favor, probably because it is so old fashioned. But it's for me, it's a if you can kind of get yourself into the 1931 mindset, it's a fantastic watch. And if you happen to be, of course, passing UCLA.
And it's like when you mentioned, you know, how green was my valley. There are some books that were great successes in their time. I remember my aunt had a copy of it in her house and I was going, oh, that looks, you know, interesting. And then it's a movie that people are not watching. It's a book that people are not reading and things fall out of favor completely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, it comes, you know, you have these genre cycles that come and go, you know, and again, like the, that East Lynne is part of the cycle of films that are often referred to as the woman's film from the 30s and 40s. And these were films that were specifically aimed at a female audience. They had a female protagonist, typically. Often the female protagonist, terrible things happen to her. And she ends up sacrificing herself for her husband and her children. And, you know, they're, by contemporary standards, they are, you know, their gender politics are very outdated and problematic. But, you know, at the time, they were the only films that actually featured female protagonists. And so they did draw a big female audience. They were very popular. And, you know, the studios did, at least for a time, put a significant amount of money into these films. You know, films in the later 30s then starring Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, etc. And that cycle of film has, you know, largely disappeared from popular view. They're talked about a bit in academic scholarly literature, but people don't tend to talk about them a whole lot beyond that.
Kevin, one of your books is that absolutely brilliant study of Irish film censorship. And I wonder, what did the Irish film censors make of some of these Academy Award winners and nominated movies?
They weren't particularly impressed by a lot of it. And since you just mentioned How Green Was My Valley, in fact, which was released in 1941, because of the emergency powers orders that were then in play here, the English national anthem was actually cut out of the film. But almost in the period really from the beginning, from 29 right through for the following 30 years, at least half of the film, of the best pictures of that won the Oscars, that when they were released in Ireland, were almost universally cut. And none of them were banned as far as I know, but following up on what Con is saying about the sexual politics of many of those films, that when it came to the conservative perspective of the film censors, they inevitably cut out things like the independent woman, a woman, say, leaving her husband, having an affair and the like, so that the version of these best pictures that were released through the Hollywood studios and that when they came to Ireland were almost universally cut. Films like Casablanca and Mrs. Miniver, which were two of the winners during the war, were both banned during the war. They were released afterwards, but even Casablanca famously, of course, had cut the scenes that really showed that Rick and Elsa didn't have an affair back in Paris because she was still a married woman, and that the Irish audiences still did not get the opportunity to realise that that relationship had actually been a fruitful one until they met up in Casablanca again. So many of the films were sanitised to the point where the original narrative strain coming from Hollywood was in fact changed, often quite dramatically, when in its Irish release version. And that, of course, wasn't unique to this particular selection, because we know that about 2,500 films were banned by the Irish censor, about another 10,000-12,000 films were cut up into the mid-60s, so that the version of the best pictures, or indeed of your favourite actor and actresses, that was actually shown on the Irish screen was often quite a sanitised version.
So poor old Irish viewers of Casablanca getting it must be a much more confusing version when bits are being cut out of it that change the whole meaning of the story.
Yeah, and the censors quite consciously try to reorientate many of these of the films to a version of it that would fit within a conservative Catholic morality. They were quite clear and explicit in the way that they set about this. So whenever there was, shall we say, a transgressive woman, that she was either cut out, eliminated, the film might be banned, or the film reorientated towards a standard family environment, which did not allow for the representation of divorce or any of the other transgressive elements that would be seen from a Catholic perspective.
Con, tonight we are talking about the undeserving winners, the worst winners and all of that. But Casablanca is the exact opposite. It is a winner. It wins Best Picture in 1944, and they win Best Director as well, and I think Best Adapted Screenplay. And it's a lauded movie, but in a way kind of an unexpected winner, because it is very entertaining. It is, I suppose, different from the types of movies that you might think would be winning a Best Picture Oscar.
Laszlo must never reach America. He stays in Casablanca.
I'm a saloon keeper. The problems of the world are not in my department. Why did you come back? To tell me why you ran out on me at the railway station?
If you only knew the truth.
I wouldn't believe you no matter what you told me.
You are our last hope. If you don't help us, Victor Laszlo will die.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
Yeah, I think it's a film where sort of the stars align in some way. I mean, I love Casablanca. It's one of my favorite films. And for me, you know, as someone who loves that classical Hollywood studio era, there's a book by a guy called Thomas Schatz, and it's called The Genius of the System, about how the Hollywood studio system was about a system that produced films rather than like the individual artist. And I think Casablanca is the perfect example of that, because, you know, it's written by four different writers. I mean, Michael Curtiz, the director, wins Best Director, but his direction is often seen as kind of not that significant a part of the film. You know, it's very effective. But really, it's about the performance. It's about Humphrey Bogart. It's about Ingrid Bergman. It's about Paul Henreid. It's about the script and all those great lines. But it really, everything came together on Casablanca. It was made from an unproduced play called Everyone Comes to Rick. And the studio reader, so these plays and other stories and things will come into readers who would make a decision whether to pass it on to a producer or not. And the studio reader read it on December 8th, 1941, which, of course, was the day after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So this film about war and about Africa suddenly was really topical, you know. And then when it was made and they ended up rushing forward the release because the Allied forces had invaded North Africa. So they rushed forward the release to release to follow up from that. But it's just one of these things where everything came together. Famously, there was a plan to shoot an ending in which, you know, the ending, famously, Rick and Renault walk off into a kind of foggy distance. There was an alternate ending where they were going to invade Africa. Thankfully, they couldn't manage to get that shot, and so they abandoned that terrible idea. So everything just came together, from the score to the as time goes by, of course, the kind of iconic tune in it. So, yeah, it is just that example of, when every now and then when Hollywood captures lightning in a bottle and you get this memorable piece of work.
And Mark, there are some years when you have a wonderful selection of movies in the Best Picture category, and then the worst of them wins. And I'm thinking of 1990, when Driving Miss Daisy was up against Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, My Left Foot, and Field of Dreams was in there as well. But, you know, of those, now you would probably rank Driving Miss Daisy fifth.
Absolutely. I mean, who watches Driving Miss Daisy now? Whereas Dead Poets Society, I think, and My Left Foot in particular are still watched. The other year that I find extraordinary now is 1994, when Forrest Gump won. I know some people liked Forrest Gump back then, but it won over The Shawshank Redemption on the one hand and Pulp Fiction on the other, two incredibly popular and enduringly popular films. I don't think a lot of people watch Forrest Gump now. Shawshank Redemption regularly scores as one of the most popular films ever. And Pulp Fiction, of course, has a huge following because of the Tarantino cult. It was another year where they got it wrong, basically.
And Mark, why do you think they get it wrong? I suppose that's what I'm trying to get at. Is it just that, you know, we can all make mistakes and we can all, with the passage of time, realise that in retrospect we preferred something different, but is it just that there was something about Forrest Gump which maybe caught the mood at the time, and Pulp Fiction was seen as maybe too risky and innovative? They probably didn't like the violence and the language, and that Shawshank Redemption was kind of a slow burner.
Yeah, I think what Ruth mentioned earlier about Taxi Driver being an edgy film when it came out, it's probably still a pretty edgy film, even by today's standards. The Taxi Driver would have been too edgy then to get a lot of nominations. And I think that's true of Pulp Fiction as well. And maybe Shawshank Redemption is a film that people watch over and over again. And like Casablanca, actually, you can watch it over and over again and it endures.
We can kind of diss the Oscars. we can be quite cynical about the Oscars. And at so many times, they have got it wrong. But when they get it right, and when they get it right for us, then it's just, you know, it's fantastic.
It is fantastic, Kevin.
Of course, Richard Harris got nominated for Best Actor for The Field, which is another Sheridan film. And then in 1993, Sheridan got nominated Best Picture for In the Name of the Father. And so that the steamroll was going. And really, the trigger moment really is when Michael D. Higgins becomes the first minister for the arts and re-establishes the film board with hugely increased amount of money. So between, as it were, the late 1980s and Charles Hoy closed down the first the film board, but also it coincides with really the end of sort of European art cinema in a way, and that reorientation towards a much more commercial narrative cinema here rather than the independent productions, which had been really the case here, working in much more modest budgets for the previous decade. So when it becomes a much more larger scale project with much more money coming in on the back of the Celtic Tiger, then there is this explosion that occurs. So there's a huge number of films that really get nominated thereafter. We have about 20 nominations of Irish people before 1989, 100 or more since then. So that is really the break that occurs.
That is the break that occurs. Well, we're going to take our own break now. When we come back, we'll be continuing our discussion of the good, the bad and the ugly of the Oscars, the Academy Awards, of course, on tonight. And we're exploring some of the things they got wrong, as well as, of course, some they got right. And we'll be right back after this. Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at some of the occasions when the Academy Awards, the Oscars, got it horribly wrong. I'm rejoined by Professor Mark Glancy of Queen Mary University of London, Professor Kevin Rockett of Trinity College Dublin and former chair of the Irish Film Institute, Professor Ruth Barton, also of Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Con Holohan of the University of Galway. Ruth, Emma Stone is up for, well, she's a producer of the movie Poor Things, so she could win for that, although, as you say, Oppenheimer will probably win. She's also up for Best Actress. She won for La La Land, and she seems to be someone who the Academy Award love because she's able to do these great performances in these serious movies, but also more popular ones as well.
She's somebody who obviously acts. So you can hardly put Poor Things and La La Land in the same, you know, generic category. You certainly wouldn't confuse one for the other if you were thinking about them. So what she's demonstrated to the Academy is she's versatile, she can take on different parts, and she's a real actor. And the acting component in particular of the voters is going to really like that. Also, she talks about her craft a lot. You'll find umpteen interviews with her, and obviously they're promoting the film hugely at the moment, talking about how she's an actor, why she's an actor, and what she does. And it doesn't harm her at all that the films that she appears in do well. So, you know, La La Land, massive success. Again, I kind of feeling it's maybe one of the films that history will forget, but at the time, everybody loved it. She's got a good acting history. So I think that stands for it. And again, to kind of just to sort of swing back to the Irish nominees, the one I feel that sort of missed out is Saoirse Ronan. Saoirse Ronan, who is, you know, has been in a wide range of films, hasn't tended to appear in Irish films apart from Brooklyn, has been nominated over and over again and still hasn't won. I don't want it to be the compensation prize, but I'm hoping, you know, down the line she'll be in that category and that she will win an award, because I think she's a fantastic actor too.
She is absolutely brilliant, but I do think she has time on her side as well. I think she's got many decades of brilliant movies to make, and I think it's only a matter of time before she will receive it. Just Ruth, on La La Land, I personally love it and watch it every few years. That was, of course, the year of the great mix-up when they announced it as the winner for Best Picture and then it wasn't.
Yes, that's right. And we love these bloopers, don't we? It is one of the Academy Awards' more embarrassing moments. Maybe it should have won as well, but I don't think so. I understand why you love it, but I don't know if I'd ever watch it again. But it is a surprise win to some extent, because it is one of the kind of lighter films. And I think perhaps it's the sort of a nostalgia award for the musical, which, you know, the musical had its heyday. in the, well, really the 30s, 40s, and then it kind of occasionally gets revived. It was a feel-good movie for a period that people maybe, you know, weren't feeling good, and I think that was why it won then. You know, best film, I don't know. I'll leave that one to you.
And Mark, of course, the Academy Awards in 2022 were completely dominated by the slap when Will Smith hit Chris Rock, and that overshadowed everything else when people were talking about it.
Yes, it was a really breathtaking moment. I think I watched it five times over and over again thinking, did that really happen? Did that really just happen? A lot of strange things have happened at the Academy Awards ceremonies. I don't think anything quite as breathtaking, appalling as that has ever happened.
And Mark, are there some deserving winners where it's clear and unambiguous that this is the recognition of brilliance and of greatness and of innovation and of all these other criteria, and that they've stood the test of time and that they very much are winners that we can all agree on?
You know, it's really hard to say that in terms of recent films, because we don't know what's going to stand the test of time. But I'll go back to the example we used earlier of Casablanca and just say, you know, what a great choice they made that year, because people do still watch that all the time. I show it to my students at Queen Mary, and they love it. So it continues to speak to generations far down the line.
Con, what about you in terms of deserving winners?
Oh, for me, certainly one of them would be Brando's win for Best Actor on the Waterfront in 1955, which is really, it's a really important award in the history, I think, of, or important performance in the history of American acting. And, you know, we can even see someone like Daniel Day-Lewis as following on from, because Brando was very much associated with the Method School of Acting in the Actors Studio in New York, which, of course, is that idea that the actor finds the emotion for the part inside of them. And On the Waterfront is just this incredible performance. The film itself won 8 awards, including Best Director for Elia Kazan, who was a controversial figure. But and it's about this guy standing up to the mob running the Dockers Union. But there's a couple of scenes in it. I think everyone probably, even if they've never seen the film, can quote the scene, you know, I could have been a contender, in which Terry is talking to his brother, Charlie, and kind of giving out to him for the fact that the mob made him throw this fight. He could have won, basically. That was his big chance. But there's another beautiful scene in which he's walking in the park with Eva Marie Saint, who's kind of the love interest in the film. And just completely accidentally, she dropped her glove while they were walking in the park. It wasn't meant to happen. And he picks it up and he just starts playing with the glove. It's this really light woman's glove, and he puts it on his hand. And it's just totally entrancing. But it's also a kind of, you know, a different kind of masculinity. He's up against, for example, Humphrey Bogart that year. And you can't really imagine Humphrey Bogart putting on a woman's glove kind of spontaneously during his performance. So it's this sort of more feminized masculinity. And again, this different kind of performance that we then go on and see in people like De Niro and Al Pacino and etc. So for me, Brando, that still stands out all these years later, and it's a film I go back to again and again.
The Oscars matter, I think, to the people who win them, because it's recognition by your peers in the field. But for all of the rest of us, I think we like them because of the attention it gives our favorite films. I mean, we get angry when our favorite films don't win, but it's also a great way to bring a film like The Crying Game or My Left Foot to a much wider audience.
Okay, well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Professor Mark Glancy of Queen Mary University of London, Professor Kevin Rockett of Trinity College Dublin and former chair of the Irish Film Institute, Professor Ruth Barton, also Trinity College Dublin, and Dr. Con Holohan of the University of Galway. Well, as I say, my thanks to all my guests. My thanks also to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and to Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week. It's a St. Patrick's Day special as we find out about the visit of all the Taoiseach in recent decades to the White House for St. Patrick's Day. And we'll also explore the enduring links between Ireland and Irish Americans. We've been talking history. Good night.